I think this happens about once a year, perhaps more. But as a big event, one of these things comes along once a year. So here we are coming up on this Sunday's March for Freedom of Choice. As far as I can tell, it's going to be a big event. The question is, how big? What are we going to hear there that we don't hear on a regular basis? The kind of droning drumbeat from the pro-choice community. Will it only be about the issue of abortion and pro-choice? We'll be talking about this Sunday's March for Freedom of Choice here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Olivia Gantz joins us from National Right to Life Committee in just a few minutes. If you'd like to join us during this 25 minutes and the following 2 hours and a half of Issues, Etc., give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In the latter part of this first hour, Dr. Patrick Gray of Rhodes College joins us to talk about abortion rhetoric. He has made a connection, I think it's a very telling connection, between the attitudes, the mindset, the mentality, sometimes the lack of mentality, that is employed by the pro-choice community and good old-fashioned superstition. We're going to talk about the superstition of pro-choice rhetoric in the second half hour of Issues, Etc. today. There in the second hour, Mark Tooley joins us. Lots going on, but what we'd like to talk about with Mark is the campaign on the part of the World Council of Churches, this huge ecumenical group called the Decade to Overcome Violence. They have put in their crosshairs, please excuse the pun, the United States as one of the greatest perpetrators of violence inside and outside its borders. We'll talk about that. Mark Tooley is from the Institute on Religion and Democracy in Washington, D.C. Open Lines follows that. We've got things to talk about. Something, picking up on something we were talking about yesterday during Open Lines, I did not get a chance to finish this. I only got a chance to start it, and that is some of the commandments that come from Rick Warren in an op-ed piece that he has written for Baptist Press. We'll pick up on some of that. Your thoughts, your ideas, your comments, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Then, in the third hour of the program, Christy Rutherford from the Family Research Council will be our guest to talk about an update on gay marriage in the state of Oregon. News today. From California, more news today, and Massachusetts, more recent news. Gay marriage all over. All of it could be put to a stop. All of it could be put to a stop by a federal marriage amendment, but that is a long-term project. We'll talk about that with Christy Rutherford in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Olivia Gantz is a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. She's director of American Victims of Abortion and Outreach and spokesman for the National Right to Life Committee based in Washington, D.C. Olivia, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be back with you.
Who is behind this coming Sunday's March for Freedom of Choice?
Well, it's the regular bunch of pro-abortion advocacy groups like NARAL and Planned Parenthood and others, the National Organization for Women. These are the groups that tend to consistently be adamantly in favor of Roe v. Wade as it stands. No restrictions, no protective measures, no recognition that abortion has been a deadly thing for both children and women since 1973. And it's tragic to see them once again mobilizing their forces in this way.
I read in Newsweek just very recently that they're a bit concerned about turnout, and they have a strategy to deal with that. Tell us about that.
Well, as usual, we're seeing them sling a lot of slogans around about their issue and how they perceive what's really going on in this debate. And they, of course, claim that they speak for the majority of Americans. And, you know, we are the ones that consistently, the pro-life movement since 1973, has consistently remained steadfast and grown in numbers. And interestingly enough, has grown in the numbers of young people. We know that Faye Waddleton's organization was recently very disheartened when their own polling data indicated that young women were in droves turning away from the pro-abortion message and moving instead in a pro-life point of view. So they're losing the next generation. And so, you know, the idea that they're claiming they're going to have this groundswell doesn't play out with what we've seen. Every year on January 22nd, come rain, snow, ice, wind, whatever, there are thousands of Americans who are strongly committed to changing the situation in this debate, coming to Washington, D.C., and gathering at their state capitals across the U.S. to say the exact opposite of whatever is going to be said this Sunday. And so that's where the consistency has been, and that's where we're going to continue to see the focus of this debate, which is on what mainstream America wants to see done with this issue.
I understand that the organizers of this March for Freedom of Choice, in order to draw a larger crowd and ensure what they hope to be a larger crowd, have actually decided to kind of widen the subject of this gathering to, if you're against the war, come out to, if you don't like George Bush, come out to, trying to bring as many people in on as many subjects, although it is supposed to be a pro-abortion rally.
Well, they don't have the numbers. That's the bottom line. As I just said, 80% of Americans do not believe that Roe v. Wade, which means abortion on demand through all 9 months of pregnancy, is a good idea. Americans are troubled. And so they understand that the numbers of abortions that happen every year is not a good idea in their minds. They don't want to see that going on. And so the only way that the pro-abortion groups could actually bring a body of people together would be to widen their circle. So, you know, they, as usual, are out of step with where the average everyday American is on these issues, and they speak for only a small radical element, so they have to unite with other radical elements in order to carry their message.
Kate Michaelman raised the issue of young women in Newsweek as well. I paraphrase, but it's a pretty accurate paraphrase. She says that this younger generation of women don't realize that Roe v. Wade could be overturned. The last time I checked, Roe v. Wade seems pretty safe. What's she trying to say here?
Well, scare people. In fact, Todd, consistently from the very beginning, the whole mindset of the pro-abortion rhetoric has been to scare people. But Dr. Bernard Nathanson, the author of Aborting America, who was one of the founders of the NARAL organization, Kate Michaelman's group, actually admitted that they deliberately came up with and manufactured statistics and numbers and stories that would scare the American public into thinking we needed abortion to be legalized. And they continue to use that same let's scare everybody tactic. The truth is that we are nowhere near the possibility. As wonderful as it would be to see a constitutional amendment, we simply don't have that possibility available to us in our Congress right now. But Todd, what people are seeing and what they want to continue to have happen is more and more protective legislation to be passed. Things like the Unborn Victims of Violence Act that the president just signed into law, you know, earlier this month, at the end of March there. Phenomenally important piece of legislation that people were behind so soundly. Partial birth abortion ban, again, a groundswell of American support for that legislation. Parental involvement laws, women's right to know bills. These are all things that we can do right now and that we should do, and none of which are out of what mainstream American thought goes along with. And they're all representative of the nature of protection that the pro-life movement wants to see pursued for children and for their mothers in the course of the abortion debate. We see abortion as violence against the unborn child and her mother, and this is what we can stop with these measures.
Olivia, let's see if we can analyze the with regard to the young women of America, the boon to the pro-life movement, but also the bane for the pro-choice movement. Why are young women more and more pro-life?
Well, there's a number of factors, I think, that we can point to that weigh into it, not the least of which is this generation is the generation that was raised after my generation went through the process of deciding to have abortions. Many of these young women are our children, or they are the children of our generation, where their brothers, sisters, friends, peers, college classmates aren't here anymore because of decisions that women like myself made 18, 20 years ago. And those of us who have lived our lives trying to piece them back together bit by bit, spiritually and emotionally and psychologically after an abortion, are trying to raise these kids. These kids have seen the fallout in our lives of what that one decision may have done to us. So I think a lot of it actually comes from they've seen it with their own eyes. They've seen that abortion didn't work. They've seen their mothers grieve. They've seen their mothers unable to deal with the stress of the entire process of what abortion did. The other thing that's reality check for us all is these kids have access to scientific information that nobody dreamt of. 4D ultrasound pictures that so many of us have seen on TV now in the GE ad. Remarkable 3D experiences of this kid, this beautiful, lovely child in the womb, swimming and kicking and moving and being one of us. These kids can't avoid the scientific truth that this is not a something, but a someone that we're talking about. So you combine the real-life experience of the fallout of generations of children that have been destroyed and the aftermath of that decimation on the emotional stability of their mothers, with the scientific reality. And these are kids who you can't lie to anymore. They want something better than abortion for themselves and their peers, and they know they have the right to demand it.
Are we seeing the seeds, if not merely planted, perhaps even sprouting, of a future, maybe a distant, but a future overturning of Roe v. Wade by this generation that has known nothing but legalized abortion and its aftermath?
Todd, there's no way in the world that we aren't going to move forward from this point. It is one of those things where once you know the world isn't flat, you have to go ahead and sail around it. And that's exactly what we're seeing starting to happen. As I say, it's interesting to note that at our pro-life marches in January and other times of the year, you see this enormous groundswell of kids, college and high school age kids coming, and they're remarkable. I was just at Bowdoin College two nights ago up in Maine, a college that boasts itself being the most liberal of all the Ivy League colleges. And yet, for 3.5 hours, we talked, a room full of predominantly young women who considered themselves both Democrat and feminist, and it was an intense and aggressive and important discussion where these young women said, "You're right. This has to be done away with because we deserve something better than being told it's us against our children." That's what the next generation is coming to grips with. Abortion is just another social cop-out for the extraordinary circumstances that often is the reality that some women find themselves in, that we need to address the real lives of women and their children, respect both of them with dignity under the law, and move our society in that direction instead of turning our backs and saying, "Just go have an abortion and leave us alone." These young women at Bowdoin College of the night stimulated me and excited me in ways I can't tell you, because they know that there has to be something better, and they believe they've got the ideas to do it.
Olivia Gantz is our guest. She's director of American Victims of Abortion. She's also director of outreach and spokesman for a National Right to Life committee based in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the pro-life issues and this Sunday's March for Freedom of Choice in Washington, D.C. One other issue that was raised about this Sunday's march has to do with the NEA, the big teachers union in the United States. And the story in the press was that the NEA is coming under some fire from its own members, public school teachers, because they are very outspoken and out front in support of this march. In particular, they're going to be providing, as they have before, hospitality rooms for pro-choice marchers here. Your reaction?
Well, we've seen this before. The NEA is not the only union. It's perhaps one of the most visible unions that has completely just sidestepped the wishes of their membership and proceeded with an extremist agenda that lines itself up with issues like the pro-abortion cause. And the reality is that this has been something that's happened in other predominantly white-collar unions. But I suggest that anybody belonging to a union really needs to double-check. Are your dues being used to support pro-abortion activities or candidates? Are you being polled? Are you being asked what you want the position of your organization to be? Certainly the NEA, the leadership of the NEA is way out of step with, again, where average teachers in Ohio and Iowa and Kentucky and Colorado and places all around the country where people are just living their lives are being basically ignored by a hardcore radical extremist leadership agenda that's being set by somebody who either doesn't want to know what you think or doesn't care what you think because they're committed to this agenda.
Something you mentioned before has to do with the legislation that's been taking place at the federal level for the first time in 30 years, some actual legislation that puts some boundaries around Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. Federally, at the state level, is the tide turning?
Oh, we definitely see great groundswell of activity. There's just so many states that have been able to pass things like parental involvement laws. There are about 28 states that had passed partial birth abortion laws. Now, it's always an issue when you're dealing with governors who may be opposed to it. West Virginia is a prime example. You've got a state there that has a resoundingly pro-life legislature, and yet they have a decidedly pro-abortion governor. So in spite of the fact that the will of the people of that state over and over again has done things like pass a Women's Right to Know bill, or as they did this year, a state version of the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, their governor chooses to completely ignore the will of the people as spoken for by their state legislators and veto that legislation. So it's, again, a question of people paying attention to what's going on. Yes, there's a groundswell. Yes, we're seeing more laws like women's right to know bills and parental involvement laws and partial birth abortion bans. And certainly, you know, all of this is progress forward that keeps the debate alive and keeps people able to voice their concerns. But people mustn't stop paying attention. And I'll say this quite simply. When they get it right, when your legislators do the right thing and pass that kind of legislation, either state or federal, contact them and say thank you. Tell them that you appreciate what it takes to go that extra mile and pass that kind of protective legislation. It protects women like myself from the violence of abortion, and it also respects and protects our children's lives as equal citizens under the law. And that's how we want to see this debated.
In that connection, how important is not only the presidential but also the Senate races, the House races in the November elections coming up?
Oh, there's no doubt in anybody's mind, Todd, that it's really critical that we continue to maintain those individuals in office who are pro-life and who are prepared to do the job at hand from the president on down, but in reality also to recognize that we need to gain more ground. The Senate is not ours to count on. We can't bank on a pro-life vote in that place. So at the federal level, yes, there's work to be done. We need to add to our numbers. The reality is for all of us, it's a recognition that this is our system. We either make it or break it by how well it's working. And if we haven't got enough votes in place to do the job, it's not working well enough, and we need to make sure we get it that way. So it is very important. It is the primary issue that many Americans vote on because they see it as a life and death question that affects 4,000 children and 4,000 women every day. That, for that very reason, it does become the paramount issue for a majority of Americans who vote on single-issue purposes. And that's where we intend to focus this year, is making sure people understand that we've gained ground, that we have a president who's willing to do what a president can do, which is sign into law those bills that our representatives pass, speaking as one for the will of the people on these critical life and death issues. And it's just the beginning of what we need to do. It's not just abortion. It's dealing with issues like euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide and watching cases like the Terri Schiavo case is a prime example of how the pro-life movement must stay vigilant on a variety of fronts and make sure you have people in place to do the job when the moment comes.
Olivia, you have watched marches like this occur year after year. What type of rhetoric do you expect to hear at Sunday's March for Freedom of Choice?
Oh, we'll hear a lot of the same fear-mongering and slogan-slinging that we've heard for years, that keep your hands off our bodies and don't force your morality on us. And you'll hear a lot of the misstatements of facts and figures. It's so easy to scare people if you don't deal in truth and you deal in generalities, and that's, you're going to hear a lot of that. You're going to hear so many of the same slogans that they're willing to drive women to the back alleys. And what we really want to see here is a time where the country debates and understands, okay, here we are, so many years after Roe v. Wade, what has this actually done in the lives of women? Nowhere in the time that we've had legalized abortion has there been any serious effort made to study intensely what the physical or psychological damage may actually be in the long term after having had an abortion. And yet, this is the most common surgical procedure performed on American women today. If this was any other kind of medical procedure, there'd be a clamor and an outroar on a daily basis to get accurate information into the hands of the public and our medical professionals. And yet on this one, because it is an agenda that some people are committed to at any cost, we keep the lid shut tight on the money and the power to do that kind of research. Because if we find out once and for all that abortion isn't good for women, and it's certainly not good for our children, then we have to ask the question, who's left in the equation that it's good for? And I'll tell you quite frankly, I know who that is. It's the people pushing this agenda, making money at the expense of our children's lives on every abortion that's performed.
Olivia, you've talked about this on the air with us before. You've had an abortion. Talk briefly about your experience and answer the question, is abortion pro-woman? Because I imagine that's going to be the overriding message of this March for Freedom.
This is the same kind of thing that's happened all the time. Those of us who have had abortions, my abortion was in 1981, and I was a student, and I was unemployed and unmarried to the father, and all of the very, very classic statistics. I went to 4 different abortion providers to find somebody that we could afford and fit other criteria that we had at that moment, and I know better than even many of my peers how degrading and humiliating the experience is, because over and over I was told by the individuals I approached that I was childish, stupid, and foolish not to realize how sensible it would be to just go ahead and have an abortion and get it all over with. And so I know that much of the slogans go out to the idea of, oh, women want this, they have the right to this, this is a life-affirming decision for women, this is a maturing event. Meanwhile, the reality of the experience of abortion that I know personally and that I've listened to from hundreds and thousands of women in all 50 states and in 17 countries outside of this country, Todd, have said the same thing. It was degrading. It was humiliating. It was something you just, a nightmare you just wanted to get through as quickly as possible and make it all go away as if you could. Because you never really forget it. There isn't a day of your life that one way or another you're not aware that it's either a secret you have to keep from somebody else or it's a secret you can't get away from because it haunts you one way or another day and night. And these are the truths that we live with. Of course, those of us who come to healing and peace of mind have done so because of the generosity and goodness of pro-life people who have compassionately said, we understand and we care. And there's forgiveness and there's love and there's hope for your future. But many of the women who will be at this march on Sunday are still lost in that pain, where they need to make abortion seem reasonable, where we need to insist that this was a good thing that happened in 1973 for women, that it liberated us. But I'll put it very simply. If women can only be liberated at the expense of their children's lives, then we will be slaves forever to that ugliness and that pain. So we have to, once and for all, tell the truth. So there will be witnesses, I know, who will be praying that day. There will be women silently standing in prayer who have had abortions who are prepared to bravely say, I regret the abortion decision that I made. I wish someone had told me the whole story before I did it. Because there's no going back and fixing it now. There's only the memory and the hope that you can do something for someone else in the future.
Olivia, with only 1 minute, it's going to be covered. We'll see all sorts of attending coverage as well. Pro-lifers are going to perhaps even hear big numbers reported. Maybe there will be big numbers. What should pro-lifers remember? How do they put this march coming up on Sunday in context?
A march is a march. But what happens is the day after and the day after, as those of us who deeply care about these issues, no matter how difficult the challenges may be to accomplish our goals, those of us who care need to keep our eyes on the goal, which is to pass the most protective legislation possible, and to use every opportunity that's presented to us to communicate that need and that desire to those that have been given by us the responsibility to accomplish that task. Make your voice heard regularly, routinely, and confidently, because that will, in the end, be the only way that we save lives. So gather if you will, pray if you can, and remember that the bottom line is what you're willing to do the day after the march is over.
Olivia Gantz, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you. Check our website, nrlc.org, if you want more information.
Olivia Gantz is Director of American Victims of Abortion, also Director of Outreach and Spokesman for the National Right to Life Committee based in Washington, D.C. That website address, again, is nrlc.org. nrlc.org. You can also call National Right to Life Committee at area code 202-626-8800. That's area code 202-626-8800. When we come back, we'll round off this first hour of Issues Etc., talking with Dr. Patrick Gray about the superstition. We know that pro-choice rhetoric is disingenuous, but is it also superstitious? We'll talk about that, Dr. Patrick Gray of Rhodes College, right after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Many today equate the worship of God with feeling good about God or about themselves. What is the genuine worship of God through which God heals our anxiety, our depression, and our guilt? Where can we find worship that's focused on God's forgiveness rather than our feelings? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for April is called They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. It's by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Richard Iyer. You can order They Will See His Face by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The book is called They Will See His Face. When you call or write, mention Issues, etc. 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on Buddhists and lets you learn some basic beliefs. All Buddhists believe in reincarnation, a series of births and deaths. After a person has released all desire and attachment to self, then a state of enlightenment called nirvana is reached. Buddhists also learn the Four Noble Truths, which explain human suffering, and the Five Precepts, which teach not to kill, lie, steal, be impure, and not to use alcohol or drugs. Buddhists live throughout Asia with significant numbers in Europe and North America. Many of them view Christianity as a religion of the West, and the concept of a personal God suffering for them is a tough idea that's not part of their culture or belief system. Pray for Christians in Asia, Europe, and North America to clearly share about Christ's love and sacrifice with Buddhist families. Learn more about Buddhist beliefs by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Right after the Berlin Wall went down, I visited churches in East Germany with the director of the German Lutheran Hour, Dr. Horst Neumann. The color of old East Germany was gray. Gray leaden winter skies, gray buildings, gray from decades of coal soot. The soul of the people was just as gray, colorless, drab. I asked Dr. Neumann why the East Germans continued to live in communism since they had little to show for it. He answered that, like Christians, they lived by faith. A deep insight. 2 Corinthians 5:7 says we live by faith, not by sight. Hebrews 11:1 says faith is a substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So, is it all the same, since most everyone has faith in something? You have heard of people who love the idea of love, but real love means loving a real person, not an idea. What makes Christian faith different from other faith systems, or should make it different for you, is not that it answers all our why questions. Martin Luther compared faith to an ascent into darkness. Life can be gray, overcast, and we often don't know why. What bearers of the name Christ know is the one we love, the one who loves you and me.
God, who created us, knows that if we ever do anything that He truly is pleased with, it's only because He's doing it through us. Even as a Christian, there's nothing you can do in order to get on God's good side. And the reason for that, understand what your relationship with God is. The reason you are saved is because of a relationship that God has created. He has adopted you into His family.
Law and Gospel, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for April is a great book. This is one of those kind of things that if you find yourself sitting in church on Sunday morning saying, what am I doing here? What is this all about? And don't be afraid of asking the question, what am I supposed to be getting out of this? Because that's what worship is about. Contrary to popular belief, I know it sounds somewhat narcissistic, but worship is not about what you do for God. Worship is about what God gives, what He does for you, and He does through the Word and His gifts of grace, the sacraments. That's what worship is really all about. So you ask yourself, what is God giving me here? What am I supposed to be getting out of this? The answer is found in our Issues Etc. book of the month for April called They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. Healing of guilt, anxiety, loneliness, depression, grief, sickness, even our minds, our intellect, all there in what God gives in Christian worship. The book is called They Will See His Face. It's $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it from Concordia Publishing House. Call them in the next 90 minutes or any weekday during regular business hours. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Browse before you buy if you like. go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find They Will See His Face and a way to order it. You can also visit one of the two locations that Concordia Publishing House has here in the St. Louis area. One here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Just follow the signs once you're on the campus. The address, by the way, 801 DeMunn in Clayton, or at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis, the main store for Concordia Publishing House. When you call, when you write, when you go in, mention Issues, etc. The book's called They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. For the remainder of this hour, Dr. Patrick Gray is our guest. We're going to be talking about the rhetoric that supports abortion. We know that it's disingenuous. We know that it is often duplicitous. Does it also indicate, well, good old-fashioned superstition? What is superstition, and can we detect it at the heart of the language used to support abortion? Dr. Patrick Gray is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled Choice Superstition. Dr. Gray, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Let's define superstition for the purposes of our conversation here. How does it apply? How would you define it?
Well, it's a hard word to define because it's always used in a pejorative sense. If you were to ask somebody if they're superstitious, no one ever says, yes, I'm superstitious. I'm reminded of a Supreme Court justice's remark in talking about hardcore pornography. He says, you know, I can't define it, but I know what it is when I see it. Everyone knows what superstition is when they see it, but it's hard to define. But when I started thinking about it, I think you can pull out a few different constants. One is that superstition, whatever it is, wherever you find it, deviates from common sense or goes against common sense. And our common sense today is science. I mean, that's kind of problematic, and we can touch on that. But deviation from common sense. Second hallmark, if you will, is emotionalism, an inability to really think on an even keel or rationally, but being swept up in emotion. Third, I guess, corruption of language, using special esoteric technology, not technology, but vocabulary, to describe pretty normal things that other normal individuals can't see. And fourth, and this is one of the things that I think is most telling and which makes a nice connection to the issue of abortion, is a power, a desire for power. When we're superstitious, when we do things like consult horoscopes, carry a lucky rabbit's foot or something like that, we want to influence events. We want to have some measure of control over the events in our daily lives. So, you know, an obsession with power, I think, is a fourth hallmark of superstition.
Can we take this analysis of the modern-day rhetoric to support abortion, and can we push it all the way back 30 years to kind of the nascent form of this rhetoric that was given birth in the Supreme Court that passed Roe v. Wade?
I think you can. I mean, I think without going back 30 years, I think I would go back at least to, first and foremost, to the Casey decision in 1992 that did uphold Roe. Rather than looking at the issue straight on, there's an oft-quoted passage from the Casey decision that says, at the heart of liberty, and I'm quoting from the majority decision here, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Now, that's pretty nebulous language that is used in the Casey decision that upholds Roe. And what it says is we don't have to adjust our lives, our way of thinking, to the way life really is, but rather it's a human right, or at least a right that American citizens have, to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning. I have no idea what that means, but what it seems to suggest is that reality is what you make it. You don't have to adjust your own way of living and thinking to reality as it really is.
When I think about the Roe Court, I think about a court that said, against common sense, very much against common sense, we don't know when life begins. They didn't just say it's not within our purview. They said, we don't know. Who knows? It's not an issue that we can deal with here. And that
right.
seems to be a little bit of the same kind of denial of common sense.
I think you're right. I mean, you have to ask what this thing is that's growing inside the womb. Is it a person? Is it a human? Is it not a human? And we come up with different terms to describe it. Well, at a certain point, it's an embryo. At a certain point, a little further along, it's a fetus. A little further along, it becomes a person. Well, have we changed genus and species somewhere along the way or not? And so you get into these finer and finer distinctions when you're avoiding the, you know, the straightforward common sense question, is it a human being or not? And you're right, I think they kind of punt on that question and avoid answering it because it's a hard one to answer.
Very recently, now this was made by at the time, a contender for the Democratic presidential nomination. It was Wesley Clark, I believe. I don't know if he slipped up or if he actually holds this view, but he said at one point, and you echo something like this as an example of the superstition in pro-choice rhetoric, he said, life begins with a woman's choice.
Yeah, troubling, is it not?
Yes.
I mean, what distinguishes, I mean, in a lot of the discussion, some thinkers will grant that whatever it is growing inside the womb is not a tumor, it is a human being. But it hasn't attained personhood. There's a whole field of study called personhood theory. Well, what distinguishes a person from mere Homo sapiens? And it appears to be the decision of the woman carrying the fetus, no more, no less. There's something that happens, something magical happens, the twinkling of an eye, to affect a change in the ontological status of the fetus when the woman chooses to regard it as her child. So I think that goes right along with what Wesley Clark was saying. And if they can do it with a fetus, why can't we do it with other things? I mean, when you try to apply that thinking to other areas of life, it becomes clear how ridiculous it is.
I mean, it reminds me a little bit, and this is a rather terrible parallel, but it reminds me of a guy in his backyard grilling hamburgers who fervently believes that they don't become hamburgers until, you know, he chooses to open up the grill, stick in the spatula, and take them out and eat them. But until that point, their status, he doesn't know what they are. He doesn't want to know what they are.
I think you've hit on a good point there. I mean, there is some degree of willful ignorance that is involved in maintaining that position. You don't, if you're driving down a road, you see a bag in the middle of the road and someone tells you, you know, there might be a live infant in that bag. Well, not stopping to think about it, to look, is willful. I mean, it's negligent. It's willfully ignorant. You need to find out. You can't avoid that hard question forever. You're right.
Is there any basis, as we talk about this pro-choice superstition, the rhetoric that flows from it, is there any basis for this willful ignorance when it comes to the scientific evidence about who the unborn is at any stage of development?
I'm not a scientist. My specialty is the New Testament, and I study ancient Greek and Roman philosophy and teach to undergraduates. So I'm not a specialist in that area. But that's actually one area where I think the tide is turning in our direction. Actually, one of my closest friends, he's a scientist. He teaches on the West Coast somewhere. He's in the closet, so I will let him remain in the closet. But he's a scientist, he's an atheist, he's a materialist, yet he is ardently pro-life, and he's one of the people that got me thinking along these lines, because he says, on the pure, you know, on the scientific facts of the case, the more we find out about neonatal development, about how brains form, when they form, with the technology that we have, it all works to convince him, and it convinced him. He used to be pro-choice himself. It's convinced him that these things are human beings, and that they feel and act like human beings, can sense things like human beings, at a far earlier stage than we ever thought imaginable. And so, in the debate these days, it's striking. Who brings scientific perspectives into the debate? More and more, it's not the pro-choice side. It's rarely the pro-choice side at this point in the debate. It's the pro-life side. So, like I said, I think that's one area where science is definitely on our side.
We're talking with Dr. Patrick Gray, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone magazine titled Choice Superstition. We're talking about abortion rhetoric. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, if you can think of an example of this kind of corruption of language born of superstition, simply denying common sense and scientific fact on the part of those who support abortion, give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Something you just said there I think needs to be repeated for the sake of our listeners, and you pointed out very well in your article in Touchstone that in the debate, it is more often and sometimes exclusively the pro-life side of the debate that wants to talk the science of the situation.
That's right. I'm not the first person to recognize this, actually. I was surprised, this was a year or two ago, I read that Stanley Fish made the same point in a public debate. And Stanley Fish is not a scientist, but he's not an intellectual who you can easily pigeonhole as a right-wing ideologue. He is one of the godfathers of postmodern literary criticism, and he surveyed the landscape and said, you know, the science is on the side of the pro-life position, and that's why you don't hear it coming from the pro-choice side of the debate. When faced with the crucial question to which science is actually qualified to speak, whether and when life has begun, defenders of abortion ignore science and want to go back to the dark ages, you know, willful ignorance, as you said before, and go back to kind of an esoteric theory of personhood, whatever that means.
Let's talk about that corruption of language a bit more. Can you give us some more familiar examples in the rhetoric of the pro-choice community that indicate a corruption of language?
I think, when you think about just the, I don't know what term we could come up with other than abortion. That's the accepted term on the table. But abortion means you're stopping something. That's just, words mean things. And so we have a right to kind of look at what the words imply. So what is aborted? Well, if it's not a living human being, then it's got to be something else, because the progressively more sentient being, not yet alive, they won't say that what's inside the womb is alive, because that would allow the possibility that it, whatever it is going to die or could die. It's clearly not dead yet either. So just what, just the term alive, you know, what constitutes being alive is something that has been confused, blurred a little bit. And I think that's very important, because whatever it means for humans to be created in the image of God, I think part of it is that we use language, and that we are somewhat unique among all of God's creatures, that we can use language and find in ever more nuanced ways, and we can only pervert language so long before it comes back to bite us in some way.
What about the glaringly truncated phrase that has now become boilerplate in the pro-choice community, the unfinished sentence, a woman's right to choose?
You never hear that sentence finished. You're exactly right. The right to choose what? And who gets to choose? What are the options? You're right. If you force people to finish that sentence, then it becomes clear what's going on. And I think there's some interest in averting our gaze from the obvious. What is aborted? Choice plays into what I was talking about before with the obsession with power. Having freedom. I mean, the perversion of language especially extends to the notion of freedom. What is freedom? What is choice? Is it the freedom to say 2 + 2 = 5? Well, no. There's a character in George Orwell's 1984 that says freedom, real freedom, is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. So I think it's seeped in and into our use of language in that area as well, that what freedom really means is no longer clear. And I think it's in their interest to keep that a little bit muddy.
What about, again, to that phrase, a woman's right to choose, what about the degree to which it makes the whole debate an abstraction? That is, we're not talking about mothers, because if we're really putting it accurately, we'd be talking about a mother's right to choose. A woman, just by virtue of the fact that she's a woman, has no real need for an abortion. Mothers do. Women who have conceived do. And this whole notion of a right as opposed to her desire, or even the term choice. Now sometimes it just says the rhetoric is just choice, as abstract as you can possibly make it.
That's right. Who could be against choice? I mean, I'm not against choice. But some choices I would be, I suppose. I mean, as long as you keep it abstract, as long as you don't press the speaker to say, well, which choices do you have in mind, then you're able to get people on board. You know, no one, like I said, no one can really, it's harder to disagree with an abstraction, as you say.
Does the pro-life community, to at least to some degree, suffer from a similar thing, not due to superstition so much, but just has fallen into the trap of talking about life in the abstraction rather than babies, infants, or if you're talking about perhaps in other areas, the disabled, the elderly, we also use the same abstraction, life.
I've never thought about it in those terms, but I think you're right. I mean, the pro-life movement has as its goal to convert those who aren't already on that side to their side. And whenever you are engaging in, an opponent, for lack of a better word, you have to speak their language. You, in a sense, have to play by their ground rules, or they can take their ball home and say, we're not going to play. So, I've never thought about it in those terms before, but the simple act of engagement, trying to be all things to all people, sometimes can lead you down a path where you compromise in areas that you don't think you're compromising, you don't think it's that important. But you're right, life is not abstract, life is in the particular. Is there such a thing as life in the abstract? I'm less certain of that than I am of the fact that there are lives in particular, and that those lives are things we can be certain of.
Well, it seems as though, you know, when we talk about life, I asked a group I was recently talking to on the issue of life, when you think about life, what springs into your mind? I got a lot of answers like movement and growth and a lot of abstractions. I said, but what is the picture in your mind? And it was obvious. The person said, a baby.
Mm.
A baby. Okay. We're not Platonists when it comes to life. We're more like Aristotle. We think about things as they are.
Right. That's and life has to begin somewhere. And it's harder and harder to come up with an intellectually viable alternative, scientifically viable alternative, to the notion that it begins at the moment of conception, especially as we find out more and more about neonatal development. You know, by day two after fertilization, we know for sure that whatever it is not a tumor. For the end of the fourth week, the nervous system, including the brain, has begun forming, the heart even sooner than that. So by the time most women know they're pregnant, that they have life inside them, or a life, that life can already respond to external stimuli. So I think you're right. I mean, that's, keeping things at an abstract level works against the cause of right, I think.
The last thing, you've mentioned this before, but the last thing that is a hallmark of superstition and pro-choice rhetoric, you said, is the goal of power. Explain that more carefully, if you would.
I mean, everybody wants some kind of power, some kind of control over things that happen, and life is a topsy-turvy thing. We don't always have control over the circumstances that affect our happiness. And in antiquity, people tried to sway, you know, you want someone to fall in love with you, you do some potion, something like that. But everyone wants some control over their life. It's not just people who are in favor of abortion. And there's no denying that having a child that you didn't plan on restricts your power in some way. I mean, only a bad parent, only a negligent parent realizes that you are restricted in some way when you have a child. And so there's that half-truth, I think, that goes with the pro-choice position, that your power is somehow diminished by having a child at a time not of your choosing. But the the book that actually I was inspired by to write this article is by Wendell Berry, and it's called Life is a Miracle, An Essay Against Modern Superstition. Now, he doesn't talk about abortion in that. He doesn't talk much about superstition, in fact. But I think the title of that book sums it up, which is Life is a Miracle, and it's a gift. And it's only a gift, really, if you take it when and where it comes, because part of being human is coming to terms with those areas where you don't have power over important things in your life.
You touched upon this just a minute ago, but I'd like to conclude our conversation with your thoughts on the issue of freedom, because the pro-choice community claims that this is a freedom issue. What is real freedom?
I think freedom is to say 2 + 2 = 4. I think freedom is a divine gift. I think it's seeing things how they really are, and then realizing your God-given potential to live the life that God wants you to live, not the freedom to redefine reality in ways that it's like a house of cards that's going to fall apart as soon as you wake up.
Dr. Patrick Gray, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Dr. Patrick Gray is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone magazine titled Choice Superstition. There's a great quote from Dr. Gray here that was pulled as one of their quotes. The surest way to keep people in the chains of superstition is to convince them that they are free. This is what's being sold American women, women all over the world for that matter, men who buy into this as well, by the pro-choice community. Here is the path to freedom. In fact, we might hear some of this on Sunday at that march in Washington, D.C. If women can't take this path, this so-called path to freedom, freedom of choice, a right to choose, all of the rhetoric. If they can't, then they never really will be free. Oh, yeah, we can vote, we can climb the corporate ladder, we can do all these things, but if you won't allow us this so-called freedom, then we will never be free. Be careful to note there that freedom is being redefined. A freedom simply to do as you please, when doing as you please takes the life of another person. Freedom to deny what is true, that the child in the womb is a child in the womb. Freedom to, in essence, tell yourself and others lies. Freedom to say things like a woman's right to choose, and a freedom to never finish that sentence if you don't want to, at least not out loud. That's not freedom. The surest way to keep someone in the chains of superstition, the kind of superstition represented by pro-choice rhetoric, is to convince them they're free. Freedom is the freedom to look reality in the face and say, yes, it is a baby. And will raising this baby be hard? Of course it will. But there's no choice in this matter. The baby's here. The baby deserves to live. Acknowledging that is really the true path to freedom when it comes to this issue. We'll be right back for the second hour of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.